Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I love this time of year. This, as soon as the solstice comes, to me, this is the real Christmas, is the 21st. When the days start getting longer, and there really isn't any big difference historically between December 21st and December 25th. They mean the same thing. It's just the issue of the calendar. It was the 20. I don't remember which calendar. There's a Roman calendar and then something else. Does anybody remember the difference in those two calendars? And they just didn't quite line up. So we get a whole span of Christmas, and I just kind of love it because as soon as the days start getting longer, I can feel that so powerfully, that it's the conquering of the darkness by the light. And that was the real meaning. Is if you can imagine being I won't say a Neanderthal, because they were really smart, but maybe Cro-Magnon or some kind of man back like that, and they would sit out by the campfire. And then the days would be getting shorter and shorter and shorter, and they would think, oh my gosh, it's ultimately going to be just darkness. It's going to be darkness. That's all that'll be left. And then suddenly it starts getting lighter and lighter and lighter. And what a rejoicing thing that would have been. And it was the conquering of the darkness by the light. And that's what I sense on winter solstice. And that, to me, is really Christmas. So, okay, just so much for that. And thanks for that second song. I like that. I'm going to take a stab at it, and I'll probably be wrong.
It's Nat King Cole, the Christmas song.
That was cool. I was thinking either Nat King Cole, but I always think of him as a deeper voice, but that was him. It's either him or Johnny Mathis, and I have no idea. So, I just want to talk a little bit about, you know, no holiday arrives, you know, in our driveway suddenly. They slowly get there, picking up all kinds of things along the way. And that's how the holidays get to us. I don't want to call them ancient, but the people of old, they had no issue about borrowing traditions one from another. They all did. And that's just the way it is. They didn't think about, you know, oh, if I take this tradition and I make it part of mine, then my tradition is really bogus because, you know, it came from something else. No, that's just the way they were. So I'm going to talk just a little bit about how the myths arrived and blended together. But first, just take a second. What's a myth? Well, okay, imagine those people again by the campfire, you know, and they, this is like maybe, we'll say it's 500 BC or something like that, and they're sitting out by a campfire and they're telling stories. You know, there's no TV, there's no cell phones. What else are you going to do but sit outside by the campfire and chat? And that's what they did, and they would tell stories. But there's other people in campfires all over the place. And they're all telling stories. And so one of them happens to go over to the, you know, walk a few miles and get to the other campfire and learns that they're telling a story that's really cool. So they go back to their campfire and they start telling that story. But they tell it a little bit differently, just a hair. You know, the names will change or a place will change. And that's okay. And then ultimately, certain stories just catch. You know, they just become really kind of interesting. They make the cut. And then you find out that cool story about something that happened becomes iconic. It becomes something that just kind of takes over. But of course, there's little versions of it here and there. And those things became our myths. And lots of them ended up in sacred writings. The Bible is just basically one collection of myths after another. And you'll find in the Bible that the same story that's told here is told somewhere else in a different book. Same story, just a little different. And people go, see, I told you the Bible contradicts itself. Well, that's not a contradiction. It's just a different way of saying the same thing. Well, that's our myths. So Christmas is a big old giant myth. And it got to us via a variety of vehicles from way back. And I want to just talk a little bit about that. But first of all, clarify, a myth is not a fake. It's not a lie. That's not what myth means. It's a beautiful old story that comes to us with amazing trappings. Christmas is a wonderful myth about the birth of Jesus. It's just beautiful. And it's not in every book of the Bible. It's really, I think it's Luke and Matthew tell the story of the birth of Jesus. And the other two books don't say a word about it. And probably the reason is because when it comes to the life and the story of Jesus, his birth really wasn't that big of an issue. And we'll talk about that in a second. But a myth. Elvis is a myth, right? I mean, does it mean he didn't exist? But he's a big story, you know, big old myth. And Trump loves to talk about his brand. He's building his brand. So what he's doing is he's trying to turn himself into a myth, okay? Joan of Arc was a myth. 9/11 has come to us as a myth. And you know what the biggest, most wonderful myth is, I think, in my opinion? It's you, you and me. We're myths. We're a story. We're a story that continues to grow and change and develop. And when I die, I hope people gather together and they share the myth of who I am. And each one of them, each person that shares that myth is going to have a different opinion, a different viewpoint of it. Because each of us are carry within ourselves a collection of myths that we have gathered. And within me is the myth of each one of you. And it's wonderful. I love carrying that myth around. You guys are just the myth of Christmas, a walking myth of Christmas. You really are, honest to Pete. Okay, so some of the pre-Christian myths. The virgin birth. Do you suppose that just suddenly appeared in the Bible? No, it's been around for a zillion years, okay? Ra, the Egyptian god of the sun god, he was born of a virgin. Horus was the son of a virgin. Her name was Isis. Phrygio-Roman god Attis was born of the virgin Nana. When? On December 25th, of course. And before 1000 BC, there were other gods or demigods that were born on the 25th of December. Horus, Osiris, I think I already mentioned Attis, did I? I don't remember. Oh, okay. And before 200 BC, there was Mithra, Heracles, Dionysus, Tammuz, Adonis, and a whole load of them, like the lesser known gods, all born on December 25th by a virgin. Why? Why do you suppose they would want to say they were born by of a virgin? What does that say, simply?
Purity.
Huh?
Purity?
Yeah, okay. And
unusual, I guess.
Yeah, imagine.
Miraculous or something.
Yeah, you would stand out from the crowd. You were born of a virgin. What can that say? You came to being outside the normal course, and you stand out from the crowd as special. And so somebody comes along that's big and wonderful and powerful, and they want to make their presence shine, then you would say, oh, they were born of a virgin. So, okay, they were born of a virgin. Were they? That's the myth. And that's all that matters, is the myth. So, the disciples of Jesus, they saw, they believed they were in the presence of someone glorious. And after his death and resurrection, they wanted to clarify how important this person really was. And so they would say things that would clarify how wonderful and important Jesus was. So what would be some things they would say 2,000 years ago as they're sitting around a campfire? He was born of a virgin. He was born, okay, well, so when was Jesus born? In the spring, probably, more than likely, because it said that the shepherds were tending the sheep at night, and that happened during lambing season, which is in the spring. Okay, so he was probably born in the spring. But they wanted to really drive home the point of how wonderful and unusual and spectacular and important this person was to them. And so he was born on December 25th. Why December 25th?
Was it the beginning of the year, the new year?
Yeah, it was. In many calendars, it is the beginning of the new year. And it is because that's when the days start getting longer. And the darkness is conquered by the light. And that's an important, critically important thing, that here comes the light, and they saw Jesus as the light. He says in the Bible, I am the light of the world.
And the pagans were already celebrating that.
All,
so they got to co-opt that and put it all together.
And many people would say to bury it.
Yeah.
You know, like a lot of times the churches are built on top of pagan temples.
Yeah.
And that's why. That's to not so much co-opt and be nice and cooperate, but to conquer, you know, So there we got, yeah, okay. I think I pounded that point to death, did I? Okay. All right. So if we just go back a little bit in time, the people of ancient Rome celebrated the winter solstice with a huge festival. Anybody know what they called that? Huh? That's okay. Yeah, I already lost it. Saturnalia, and Saturnalia was meant to give thanks to Saturn, the Roman god of wealth and agriculture and liberation. And by that time, December 21st, the last planting of the season had been completed. And so it was a time to kind of give thanks and be grateful. And so Saturnalia began on December 17th, and it continued on until December 24th. So it was an extended party, and that's what it was. I mean, come on, they were partying down. Romans had a way of really partying a lot. And so they did it really good, but just picture it, Rome. In the 3rd century BC, and Romans of every social class mingled in what can only be described as the ultimate costume party, or some might call it the ultimate drag party. Enslaved people and the enslavers would swap roles, and men would wear women's clothing. And basically what Saturnalia did was to encourage the upending of all social hierarchies. It was where and revelry just reigned supreme. It was a time when the usual roles of society were put on pause. And it was kind of a social reset. where everyone got a taste of what life would be like on the other side of the divide. Okay? At its core, Saturnalia was about questioning social norms and embracing a more fluid way of existing. It was I was looking and doing a little bit of research, and one of my feeds is The Advocate, which is a gay newspaper, and it's excellent. It's really good. And it started sharing some really cool stuff, and one of the ways they put it, they said it was a carnival-esque free-for-all where the rigid lines of social class and gender melted, even if it was just for a week. It said 25th of December, where did they... Okay, it was considered, the 25th of December was considered the climax, and it had a special name, just the 25th. It was called Brumalia, and this period was known for just widespread drunkenness and gambling and debauchery, but it was only for the upper class. So there you go. There was a line in there that was so cool, and I lost it. Maybe I'm not supposed to say it. Maybe not. The Emperor Aurelian, he declared the 25th of December to be the birthday of the unconquerable sun, which really gets to the point. And it was it was dedicated to the Iranian sun god Mithra, who was the god of sun, justice, and war, and also to the Roman god Sol. And other than Saturnalia, there are also all sorts of festivals during this time. One of them was Yule, and it was celebrated largely by the Norse people of Northern Europe. And there are lots and lots and lots of Yule traditions that came down the pike, and we still celebrate them. It lasted for 12 days, and it was huge bonfires that were lit. There was feasting and, of course, drinking. And a Yule tree was decorated around that time of the winter solstice, and there was a Yule log that would be lit so that families could feast and make merry all night long. And then there was a Yule ham that was traditional, and that was because the boar was a sacred beast to the pagan god Freyr. So the ham became a big deal. And obviously, we have stolen a bunch of those, haven't we? So Christmas is bogus? No, Christmas is just rich with tons of tradition. Another important pagan holiday was the birthday of the Greek god Dionysus. And this god of wine was celebrated with lots of revelry and feasts, and guess what, drunkenness and merrymaking for 12 days. Yay. His birthday, I can't even do it for 12 hours. His birthday was imagine what his birthday was, Dionysus, December 25th. Mm-hmm. So, the festival was called Bacchanalia, and it was marked with wildness and drunkenness and partying. Imagine that. And in Finland, the goddess Bue was celebrated also during that time, and she was said to ride a sleigh made of reindeer bones and pulled by white reindeer. Where do we get these traditions? The Romans used to hang small metal ornaments on trees outside of their house during Saturnalia. So, where do we get the idea of trimming the tree? Early Germanic tribes, they would decorate trees with fruit and candles to honor the god Odin. The Anglo-Saxon traditions, they had one of going door to door and singing to their neighbors, and they called it wassailing. It came from the phrase was hail, which means to good health. And my patron saint, Saint Francis, co-opted that particular tradition, and he would get his people and they would go around and sing Christmas carols door to door. So that's where the tradition came of going door to door and singing Christmas carols. So what's another gigantic tradition in Christmas?
The tree?
Inside. I don't know when they brought it inside. I was just reading yesterday a tradition of the first person to start selling trees in New York City. He brought them in and had a stack of them, and they sold out within an hour. And people were bringing their trees inside to decorate. How about Santa Claus? Yay, Santa Claus! We got to at least give a little nod to Santa Claus. It's a bearded man in red boots, and he has myths that are just a big gob of myths that developed to create Santa Claus. And one is England's Father Christmas, which is really kind of the very personification of the holiday. And his story is mixed with deities and spirits, but then there's also the myth of Nicholas of Myra, who was the a Greco-Christian bishop of Myra, which is in modern-day Turkey. And he had the habitual habit of going around and giving gifts to children, and he bought them out of prostitution. He was just a kindly old bishop that would go around and do wonderful things, and everybody loved him. He was imprisoned for a time under the persecution of the Emperor Diocletian, but he got released when Constantine the Great came to power and made Christianity the official religion of the empire. He died in the 340s, but he's a myth, right? Did he exist? There was a lot of question about that, okay? Well, after these archaeologists were doing tons of work, and this year, recently, I don't know how many weeks ago it was, the archaeological team that had been working on the Church of St. Nicholas in Dimre, Turkey, announced that they had found a sarcophagus that was extremely likely the body of old St. Nicholas, of the Bishop of Myra. The team leader said that it was the first sarcophagus they came across when they were excavating under the church, and that drilling work began in 2022. And they said that it had been covered by gravel and sand, probably from a tsunami or a flood, and that's why the sarcophagus was so well preserved and hidden. Wow, getting real, isn't it? Santa Claus nearly at our door. Well, it's pretty clear that institutional Christianity did its very best to sanitize the wildness of the vestiges of Christmas that came to us through Bacchanalia and Saturnalia, but they didn't succeed very well. Saturnalia's open display of role and gender reversal and permissive mingling of the classes, well, maybe that had vanished. And what remained was kind of a sanitized version of Saturnalia. We would give gifts, feasting, a general sense of merriment, maybe have a drink or two. It's like the spirit of it was still there, but the grit, and the edge was gone. From the Advocate, I read this one line, said, it's kind of like when your favorite gay bar where people would go to really celebrate role reversal and get free from societal demands had turned into a high-end cocktail lounge.
I want in.
Yeah. I thought that was a perfect line. It wasn't so much fun, but at least people could get drunk. So all the drunkenness and the debauchery around the season caused Christmas to eventually get banned in various places at various times because it was just too naughty. And Christmas was celebrated for 12 days, and that ended up being basically a two-week bender for a lot of people. So one place in England, the Puritan government banned Christmas totally for 18 years, claiming that it was wasteful and sinful, and it went against Christian values. Can you imagine saying Christmas goes against Christian values? Well, they did. And it said anybody caught celebrating was fined 5 shillings. So they worked really hard to scrub away the roots of Christmas, but it still is here to some extent. Christmas didn't become a legal holiday until 1870. And by that time, in this country, the Victorians had steered it away from the drunken debauchery and turned it into something a lot more proper, similar to what we have today. How myths change, how they evolve over time. And today, when we celebrate Christmas, some people celebrate it just as humanitarian, being nice to one another and sharing gifts. Other people look at the root of the Christian tradition. And the Christian tradition of Christmas at its true basis is very radically different than the celebration of the various gods, because at the basis, the gods were powerful. They were rich. They were to be feared. And they were to be celebrated with drunkenness and debauchery. And that's what it was all the way across the line, every single one of them. All those things that I mentioned before that brought Christmas to this day, all except for the Christian tradition, they were the celebration of something big and powerful, and you got drunk. But the story of Jesus' birth, the reason I see it is so radically different, is his birth is one of a simple, humble, poor woman who was pregnant out of wedlock. Doesn't sound much like the previous traditions, but that's where it was. She was to bear the Son of God without an earthly father. Her condition, by law, would have led her to be stoned to death, and yet it says that she chose to take that risk. And then she also chose Joseph of Arimathea to cover for her as her supposed husband. And they came to Bethlehem to be taxed, but they didn't have any place to stay. And so they took shelter in what they call a stable. But the stable was almost certainly the downstairs room of a relative's home. And they went there because there wasn't any place else for them to go. And the residence quarters were filled, which residence quarters mean, residence quarter in that time and age was always the upstairs, because they would sleep above in the open air because it was hot. And so what was the downstairs for? That was cattle. That's where the cattle were kept. And so it would have smelled of urine and excrement. And when it came time for her to bear the child, the only place for her to lay the baby was in the manger. And what's a manger? It's the feeding trough. If you speak even just a teeny bit of French, you know, manger means to eat. And it's spelled in French exactly like our English word manger. And it's where the cattle, it was the food place for the cattle. And so she laid the baby in the manger. And so the greatness of Jesus was not reflected at all in the humbleness of his birth. But it was hinted at by certain myths, like the wise men who came to bear gifts. The three wise men, right? There was really a fourth one, but they kicked him out because he brought fruitcake. So, Oh, well. Jesus, is nowhere in the Bible does it say that he saw himself as exalted. He eschewed terms like Son of God. And when, you know, he told people, just don't even talk about it. Don't mention it anymore. And he even said such things as, greater things than I do, you will do. So at no point did he see himself as someone to be put up on a pedestal, or certainly to be worshipped. I believe that he knew what greatness was. He wasn't born into an ignorant family by a long shot. Mary and her mother Anna were brilliant women of great spiritual wisdom. And Joseph of Arimathea was a very wise and able man. He was a perfect guardian for the growing Jesus. They would be then joined by others that had tremendous knowledge. Hardly the least of these was Mary Magdalene, a very wise, wise woman, and a perfect female counterpart for Jesus. Greatness was in his blood. And I personally am very grateful for this day, because it's when we celebrate the birth of my own spiritual guide, who, as I feel it, has become my friend, who walks with me always and has led me against all odds safely to this day. I don't know how many times I've practically killed myself or been killed one way or another, and somehow or another I'm still standing here to be able to give this talk, and I'm grateful for that. When I walk out in the woods, always, always, I take some moment and I ask Jesus, who is right there, protect me and my dog. You know, because there's a lot of crazy things out there in the woods, usually other crazy dogs that run up and bite other dogs, which has happened to me a few times. So I ask him for his protection. Our mythology says that on this day the consciousness of Christ became flesh and walks among us. And this birth isn't just limited to Jesus of Nazareth. The greatness of him who said, I and the Father are one, extended that and the date of his birth to anyone who would allow this to be their birthday as well, who would choose to be reborn on this day. And so the question I have is, and by the way, I've given this talk before, and this little line was something that Doug said that he remembered. The question is, am I humble? Am I humble enough to be born in a stable where cattle are around and it smells of urine and feces? Am I humble enough for that? But on the flip side, would I allow the full consciousness of Christ to rise up in me and allow me to bear within myself the greatness of the Word of God? Can I do both? We're called by the spirit of Christmas not to worship the baby Jesus in a crib, but instead, on this day, to choose to be the real presence of Christ in a world that is desperate for that. And I sense that Christmas comes on the winter solstice when the light is conquering. And so it's the day that I make my decision this year. Do I want to be reborn? Or do I choose to continue on the way I am? And it's your choice. Christmas is your myth. It's yours. You fashion it, you mold it exactly the way you want to. I want it to be my own birthday. I want my own birth and rebirth again and again each year to come to me as a child of God. And nothing would be more amazing and literally awesome than for the myth of the birth of Christ consciousness, the myth of the birth of Jesus becoming flesh to be made real in each person. Would that not be something that you would hope for, that you would pray for, that you would choose to make happen? For us to allow ourselves to become the human face of God is the goal of Christmas. And if that were to happen, it's on that moment that I would, with all sincerity, say, Merry Christmas.